Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in a moment, the economic crisis is resulting in some radical rethinking, like how about your job being your source of income instead of your house? But first, federal prosecutors have notified a New York court that they want the assets of Bernard Madoff's wife. Last week, Madoff pleaded guilty to securities fraud and perjury and other charges, and Ruth Madoff hoped to keep a penthouse in Manhattan, other homes, and $62 million. Well, let's start today with Madoff and the whistleblower who tried to tell federal regulators about his Ponzi scheme. Here Now's Kurt Nickisch spoke with Harry Markopoulos, the Massachusetts fraud investigator who tried to get the Securities and Exchange Commission to investigate Bernard Madoff. Kurt, you're the only journalist to speak with Markopoulos since last week's guilty plea. What was his reaction?
He's actually far from satisfied. If anything, the news discourages him, because for him, it's another reminder that he failed. You know, after all, the Ponzi scheme came undone on its own, not because Markopoulos exposed it. And that weighs heavily on his heart still today. Markopoulos says he wakes up in the middle of the night thinking about the people whose lives are now forever changed, a fate he wasn't able to avert. It's really kind of an amazing personal journey. You kind of want him to, you know, and the people who helped him look into this, write a book. But listen to what he says about that.
I don't know. I'd rather have him write a book than me and my team. I'd rather hear what his thoughts are. I wish he would unburden himself. I would challenge him to do that. If there's any redemption that this man is looking for, writing a book and telling us what was in his mind and why he did it, it would mean a lot. And it would go far toward making people perhaps think a little bit better of this man, as bad as he is, to let us know that he has a shred of decency in him after all, and he's not a total monster.
Now, I'm not sure that I would want to be the publisher pushing any such book. Markopoulos is onto something, though. The fact is, people lost their money. They're not going to get much back. So they're going to have to come to terms with it, you know, one way or the other.
Well, and he, of all people, must be, you know, dying to know how did this truly happen and how does he feel? Well, let's talk about the SEC. Markopoulos tried for 10 years to get the regulator to investigate. They didn't. Why didn't anyone listen to him?
Well, that's what the inspector general of the agency is looking into, and that report is going to be really, really interesting. Markopoulos just says, you know, they were incompetent and afraid. Even so, he did meet with the head of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, this past week, and he says he's encouraged because they're rapidly making some changes that he recommended. Obviously, there's a lot of culture to change there. For instance, when he was trying to expose the Ponzi scheme, he had this interaction with the SEC that I think says a lot.
In New York, I only had dealings with one person, Branch Chief Megan Chung. She was an attorney by training, had no finance background. She was very arrogant, very close-lipped, and she bragged that she had done the Adelphia fraud and that she could certainly handle the Madoff fraud. And I explained to her that the Adelphia fraud was a simple $3.5 billion accounting fraud and that this was a $30 billion derivatives fraud, much more complex than and much larger in size, certainly than Adelphia, and I questioned whether she had the background for it, and she proved me right. She did not have the background for it.
Now, from that, you can tell Markopoulos is not the most tactful, but that's actually his strength. It's exactly that trait that meant he wasn't snowed by this respected former NASDAQ chairman, an incomparable schmoozer. He saw right through to the facts. You know, forget being uncouth. The notes that he gave the SEC were dead on. They ooze common sense, but the SEC just overlooked them.
Well, now in the aftermath, authorities are trying to find any cash that's left. As we said, prosecutors want to seize the assets of Madoff's wife. Does Markopoulos know how much money is left?
Unfortunately, he says not very much. Madoff may have taken in about $65 billion overall. Well, most of that went back out to people who were living off the yearly interest, for instance, to foundations that made donations each year, for instance. Markopoulos also thinks that some of those investors might have suspected Madoff was a fraud but didn't do anything. In any case, he says many people must have had direct knowledge of the Madoff scheme to actually help Madoff carry out the operation.
He had to have many. I don't know how many he had on the 17th floor, but he had a lot because he had people taking in wire transfers from all over the globe, many billions of dollars. And he also had people making falsified statements for trading records and sending them out every month, thousands of them. So he had to have a robust information technology system to support sending out that many thousands of false statements. And he also had to send out wire transfers every month to the people that were living off the investment income that he was purporting to be earning for them. So keeping all that straight and then dealing with all the feeder funds and all the private client banks and all the fund of funds, it was a massive undertaking. He did not act alone. He had help, and I'd like to see the helpers behind bars.
And that may be a long legal road if they're just homing in now on Madoff's wife.
That's Here and Now's Kurt Nikisch. Kurt, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Well, out of the ooze of the entire economic collapse, new ideas are taking life. Time magazine's annual special issue lists the 10 ideas transforming the world, and number one, jobs as an asset. Wow, your job is an asset and not your house. What a concept. Time magazine's Lev Grossman edited the series, and Lev, your writer, Barbara Kvyat, writes that Americans have to think of their jobs as paying the new dividend. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's quite counterintuitive, as a lot of these ideas are. Essentially, you know, we've been trained by the economy, I guess, for the past couple of decades to think of the sort of engines of personal wealth creation as being real estate, stock options, and the humble job has kind of fallen into disrepute. We don't respect it the way that we used to. But one of the funny effects of the credit crunch is that we're coming around to the idea that the job truly is the principal asset of personal wealth, and it's taking up its place again at the top of the heap.
Well, and one of the things that's happened over the past couple of decades, the percentage of families in the stock market jumped from 32% to 51%. The amount of money that families had in the stock market soared from just 28% of financial assets in 1989 to 53% in 2007. You know, as you say, this is part of looking at dividends, stock dividends, instead of looking at what? The dividend from what's happening in your head, from what you yourself can produce?
Well, people stopped really thinking of that as an asset, as something they owned, as something that created wealth, their personal skills, their personal knowledge. That kind of got taken for granted and sort of lost its luster compared to all the sexy stuff that was going on elsewhere.
Well, something that underscores this thinking that, you know, maybe our jobs should be what we think of as our, you know, human wealth, a dividend on our human wealth. The book that was written in 1970, What Color Is Your Parachute, is back on the bestseller list, and this is a book about job hunting and career changing.
That's right. It's one of these funny instances where a change in the economy really changes the way we think about our lives, almost our sort of spiritual health. The new focus on work and on the job and its importance is causing people to think differently about how they work and what work means, and try to endow their work with a kind of richness and an emotional investment that it really hasn't had for the last few decades.
Well, this is as unemployment is edging up, so it's kind of like you don't know what you've got till it's gone, because jobs are disappearing. Well, number two on the list of Time Magazine's Ideas Transforming the World, Recycling the Suburbs, Recycling What's Known as Underperforming Asphalt. Explain that.
Well, a lot of Americans live in suburbs. It's one of the classic American social innovations. And it's not working as well as it used to. There are hordes and hordes of McMansions, huge, overinflated, overpriced houses built around shopping centers, which the economy is just no longer set up to support. And as a result, a lot of shopping centers and big box stores are failing. A lot of subdivisions are going unsold. So you have these huge tracts of land, these huge structures, and people are looking for ways to repurpose them. And what's happening is they're taking old Kmarts, old Walmarts, and turning them into community centers and libraries to try to make them live again in our very changed circumstances.
You take a look at Lakewood, Colorado, Long Beach, California. Both towns have repurposed boarded-up malls and turned them into mixed-use developments, offices, apartments, because as your writer, Brian Walsh, notes, 148,000 stores closed just last year. That's the most since 2001. And you also quote a Virginia Tech study predicting that there are going to be a surplus of 22 million large lot homes by 2025. So, you know, we have this combination of useless land.
And the urgent question becomes, do we knock these structures down? Do we allow them to fall into ruin? Do we flee further out of the city, further into the country? Or do we look hard at these things that we've built that we no longer can buy or sell and think what good can come out of them? And I think that's really, you know, one of the themes of the package, this kind of sense of renewal. Things that no longer have a purpose in the new economy, don't seem to work anymore, things that are broken, being given sort of new life through the resourcefulness of the people who reinvent them.
Well, that brings us to number four on the list, which is reinstating the interstate. The interstate system was built in the mid-50s. Your writer, Richard Lacayo, calls it a monument to the law of unintended consequences. What did he mean by that? And what's the big new idea with the interstate?
Well, the interstate system in the United States, 47,000 miles of highways, probably the biggest public works project in the history of the country. It didn't quite work out in every sense that we expected it to. It contributed to suburban sprawl. It contributed to our obsessive car culture, which makes us dependent on fossil fuels. So it's enormously useful, but also enormously destructive. And we're looking for ways to revitalize it and put it to better use. And what communities like, for example, Portland have figured out is that once you have all these streets in place, you've got, you know, the legal right-of-way, and you can do all sorts of things with them that nobody ever expected. You can run light rail through them. You can set up solar panels. It's an enormous resource, and we just have to sort of look at it in a new way to figure out what it's good for.
Right, because as you point out, the government owns the land adjacent and often the rail beds all along this huge interstate system. So it's as if the grid is already laid out. Why not put a new electric grid right alongside it, you know, because the land is already owned by the government?
We just have to look at this highway system as a kind of a nerve system, and we can run anything down it that we want to. We used to run cars, and I'm sure we will continue to do so, but now we can run other things as well.
Well, let's go to number 5 on the list before we take a break. It's amortality. It's a word that was coined by your writer, Catherine Mayer. It refers to people who don't want to act their age. You quote our friend Ray Kurzweil, who encourages everyone to forestall aging so we can all be alive to take advantage of new technologies that will help us live forever. What's your sense, and what's your writer's sense? Is this just, you know, baby boomer vanity? Or is this also a little bit the economic necessity of boomers who now think they are going to have to work forever?
It's really all those things, and a few other things that we haven't mentioned. It's a trend that combines not only some sort of familiar phenomena, like celebrities use Botox, nobody wants to look old, but also young people who've become incredibly enriched by the dot-com era, like the billionaire Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, and also enormous advances in science. There are researchers out there who view aging essentially as a disease that can be cured. And the upshot is people are basically not aging. Once they reach the age of, say, 25, they continue to look and act the same way on into, you know, their 60s and 70s. So the idea of amortality really is this sense that aging is becoming irrelevant. And I suppose the next step would be to put off death itself.
Well, and just in on the more mundane, if aging is irrelevant, a lot of those people in their 60s and 70s are going to be holding on to the jobs that the 40, 50-year-olds aren't going to get.
That's true. It raises profound social and economic questions. What's going to happen to these people who are working and refusing to retire? And also, goodness knows, if they're living into their 90s and 100s, what kind of unforeseen health care costs are they going to require?
That's Lev Grossman of Time Magazine with their 10 ideas that are changing the world. For instance, here's another one, Africa as a business destination. We think of war and famine, but actually most Africans, well, not middle class, are moving out of poverty, and businesses from around the world are moving in. We're going to have more with Lev. Also, quick note, later today, going undercover at a factory hog farm. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Lev Grossman of Time Magazine, who edited their cover story, The 10 Ideas Changing the World Right Now. Here's another one, biobanking, banking your DNA and tissues at research centers. The only payoff, they may find a cure for what ails you or a loved one someday. And Lev, idea number 7 is called Rent a Country. It's about food supplies. Now, your writer, Krista Mayer, writes about last year's food riots in Haiti in particular, but she writes after those riots, something happened. A few diplomats and business leaders quietly boarded their jets and got to work. What happened?
This is probably my favorite story in this package. I find it absolutely fascinating. The nugget for me is a single fact. A South Korean corporation called Daewoo last year rented 2.2 million acres in Madagascar. Half of the arable land in Madagascar was simply rented for the private purposes of a South Korean corporation. What's happening is that countries and other kinds of entities which are very poor in land but rich in cash, are coming to countries that have no cash but have lots of land and just saying, you've got a lot of land, we're just going to rent it for you. We're going to take it over. We're not going to invade you, and we're not going to buy this land. We're just going to rent it temporarily, and we're going to reap the benefits of it. And here, you can have all this cash. What it amounts to is a new kind of financial and political relationship between countries that never existed before. We have no idea what kind of effect they'll have.
Well, and, you know, some have sort of worried about this looking like colonialism. But as you said, the countries that are renting the land are being paid.
It's true. And a lot of times the countries that are doing the renting, they'll build up the infrastructure in the country that they are renting. So in a sense, everybody wins. It's kind of colonialism light, if you will.
Yeah. You spoke of South Korea. Give me some other examples.
It's clear that Saudi Arabia is looking for opportunities in this area. The primary candidates, really, are in Southeast Asia, Laos and Cambodia. India is a big candidate. These countries that have enormous, sprawling tracts of land and just don't have the resources to develop them.
Yeah. Let's move to number 9 on the list, survival stores. Your writer, this is Sean Gregory, says people aren't buying what they used to, and they're not buying it in the same way. We need a whole new kind of store. Tell us about this concept of the survival store.
Well, the idea here, which comes from Simon Grash, who's a sort of retail guru, is to set up a kind of store where conspicuous consumption and the sort of hard sell, the old slick salesmanship, simply does not exist. What you have is a store where people can buy absolute necessities, bicycles, generators, cheap but nutritious food, places where they can get trained in new skills. The idea is just to strip out all that sort of foofy commercial kind of fetishization, and just get back to the absolute basics.
Well, and this is catching on in some places. The French-based retailer Carrefour, I think I've said that correctly, has hypermarkets where consumers can buy food but also have the computers fixed. So it's sort of what do you need to get through the day. But when you, I see the list here of the products that would be in these new survivor stores. There's canning jars, and there's a rainwater barrel and some sewing things and crafts things. This, it's like everything new is old again. This sounds like the old five and dime.
It is a bit like the old five and dime, and I think that we're seeing a lot of people alter their lifestyles in this direction. You know, the whole iPod culture, buying gadgets you don't need, buying things and throwing them away, it's just not going to cut it in the new environment.
Well, number 10 on Time's list of the ideas that are transforming the world, ecological intelligence. Now, we've reported a lot on this here, but the trick is how to really be smart and do the right thing for the economy. Let's say you want an organic cotton T-shirt. That's good for the environment. But then it takes over 2,000 gallons of water to grow enough fiber for one shirt. That's bad for the environment. So what's the new ecological intelligence?
We need to start thinking about the long-term consequences of our sort of consuming habits. When we buy something, we buy a manufactured good. We can think about it in the short term, you know, what it costs us, what it gets us, but we have to start thinking about the larger kind of infrastructure that produced it. You know, what toxic chemicals got released, what kind of labor went into it, what kind of impact it had on the environment, and what kind of impact it'll have on the environment after we're done with it, when we throw it away. And this fellow, Daniel Goleman, who's the fellow who came up with emotional intelligence, is exploring how we have to change the way we think, and we sort of understand our own actions in this new ecological context.
Right. And you talk about companies that are doing this. I mean, this is part of the new economy, these companies that are springing up that crunch the data. We spoke to a company named Ceres that works with investors who are concerned about how much water gets used to make products. There's another company here, Good Guide, which uses data to judge products, and they crunch the numbers on Adora the Explorer doll to see, you know, did it have arsenic? Did it have mercury? You know, did it create air pollution in making it? And then you can tell, and so you can judge the carbon footprint, the ecological impact of Adora the Explorer doll, because they crunch the information for you. One last thing that your writers found, the idea, the new idea of Calvinism. Calvinism is back. Remind us, what's Calvinism and where do you see it back?
Well, Calvinism is a Protestant faith that was developed by John Calvin in the 16th century. Its central tenet really has to do with predetermination, the idea that certain people have been saved and that God knows that they were saved, and really nothing they can sort of think or do can change that. it was an idea that flourished, you know, in the Renaissance period, and then fell away. But oddly enough, it has lately been revitalizing the evangelical movement.
Well, and your writer David Van Bima illustrates this through music. He writes, in the early 1900s, you could have heard the old rugged cross, you know, about atonement. But by the 1980s, people were bringing guitars to church and you were hearing, you know, Jesus is my buddy songs. And then today we have the Dave Crowder Band singing, you know, lyrics that seem Calvinistic. I am stained with dirt, prone to depravity. Calvinism is back, he writes.
The God of Calvinism is a very strong God. He's not your buddy, you know, he's not your boyfriend, he's not your pal. He's a real fierce, paternal God who knows all and can do all. One really must just sort of submit to his will. It's a new way of thinking about God that's very different from the tone of the evangelical movement in the 90s.
Well, at least according to the research of the writers of Time magazine, that's Lev Grossman. He edited Time magazine's cover story, 10 Ideas Changing the World Right Now. By the way, to link to the article, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Lev, thanks so much for giving us this peek into the future that, at least for some people, is already here.
Well, thank you so much.
There were celebrations in Pakistan today after the news that the country's ousted Supreme Court Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chowdhury, will be reinstated. This morning's announcement came after a weekend of protests against the government of President Asif Ali Zardari and halted a march on the capital by former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who leads the opposition. Nazez Afros is executive editor for the BBC Asia region. He joins us from London. And Nazez, I guess the question is, what's next? Because it seems as if everyone now occupies a new place on the chessboard.
It's very interesting. I mean, it just felt like over the weekend that Pakistan was going to implode, because Nawaz Sharif made it very, very clear that his intention was to bring down the government.
This is the former prime minister who was geared to lead a big march.
Yes, and it almost felt like a deja vu. This is what General Musharraf, the former ruler of Pakistan, he did when his political opponents, they tried to bring in democracy. At that point, there had been clampdowns, the protesters were arrested, and there were clashes between the protesters and the police. So now you have the two political parties face-to-face, almost identical situation. For a year, this standoff has been going on. So it felt like that it was going to implode. But now, Iftikhar Chowdhury, the former Chief Justice, he'll be reinstated. We have to see what would be his position. What is he going to do after this? Also, Nawaz Sharif and his political party, where they will be. Over the next couple of days, I think the picture will become clearer.
But can we tell already that there's been a shift in power? Is the assumption that the march by Nawaz Sharif, again the former prime minister, is what pushed the president, Zardari, to make the announcement that the Chief Justice, the ousted Supreme Court Chief Justice Chowdhury, would be reinstated? Is this seen as Nawaz Sharif, you know, suddenly having the upper hand and more power?
Absolutely. There is no doubt that President Asif Ali Zardari has been weakened. Over the last 4 or 5 days, ever since the announcement of the long march, which Nawaz Sharif announced about a month ago, and after that, all the preparation. During the preparation time, there has been crackdown over political activists all over the country, which did not go down well with the civil society. They said that, okay, you are a political party, you talked about democracy, now you are clamping down on political activities. It was not on. Even there is division with in his own political party, the Pakistan People's Party, led by President Zardari. Some ministers have resigned even. Nawaz Sharif will have definitely much more clout now.
Well, put this in the larger international context. In the recent news headlines, India still outraged at Pakistan for, according to India, harboring insurgents who attacked India. Officials in Afghanistan looking over the border at Pakistan, feeling that homegrown insurgents are coming from Pakistan into Afghanistan. The U.S. Carrying out missile strikes against insurgents in Pakistan. You know, put this, all this unrest, in that context.
This is a big, big headache. On one hand, Pakistan military is involved in this long campaign that has been going on since 9/11 in the tribal belts in Pakistan, which is bordering Afghanistan. Some parts are completely in the total control of the local Taliban. Everyone knows about it. Now, in the middle of all that, if you have this political instability inside the country, who is going to fight these elements? This is the reason we know over the last 4 or 5 days, there has been lots of phone calls from Washington. We know that Richard Holbrooke, who has been made a new envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he had conversations with President Zardari. He had had conversation with Nawaz Sharif. The U.S. ambassador in Washington played a very important role. So all that was going on. So one can very well imagine how important Pakistan and its political situation is.
And how long do you think the current calm, you know, after the reinstatement of Iftikhar Chowdhury, how long does this last?
It's a very interesting question. One must remember that there is another very important player in Pakistani politics, that is the Pakistan Army. And they also would like to have a political process, a stable political situation inside the country so that they can also concentrate on the tribal areas and they can deliver something. So with the international intervention as well as the intervention of the army, possibly there will be a period of stability.
Nazeh Zafros, executive editor for the BBC's Asia region. Nazeh, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and coming up in just 30 seconds now, we'll speak with a man behind an undercover investigation into allegations of animal abuse on a hog farm in Ohio. That's in 30 seconds. You're listening to Here and Now. We welcome you back to Here and Now with a warning that our next story may be disturbing. Those are piglets being torn from their mothers by an ear or a leg and then thrown into a bin. Those that are sick will be whacked against a wall or hit with a hammer by the adult son of the farm owner. They'll twitch until they die and then be thrown into a pit filled with other dead pigs. It's a scene from the HBO film Death on a Factory Farm that tells of the undercover investigation into alleged abuses on the Wiles Hog Farm in Creston, Ohio, and the court trial that followed. The film also details pigs dying a slow death caught in the tight cages they live in, pigs cannibalizing other sick pigs, and ultimately huge sows, called downers because they can't walk, being hung by chains pulled by a forklift until they die. A judge found very little of this punishable under the law. Now, we rush to say we know there are farms that treat animals humanely. We visited a hog farm in Pennsylvania where pigs roam the fields, play in the mud, but that farm was supported in part by Philadelphia restaurateur Judy Wicks, and some animal activists worry we're creating two farm worlds, one for privileged restaurants and one for the bacon and eggs crowd. Pete is the man who did the undercover investigation for the Humane Farming Association. He goes by that name because he's undercover. And Pete joins us from NPR New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tough stuff to look at. Tough for you to see?
It was tough for me to see. I've been doing this work for a number of years, and there's always something that still manages to startle and surprise me, and this was no exception.
How did this investigation start? Why did you go to this particular Wiles farm?
There was a whistleblower at the farm. She had discovered what was going on at the pigs, that they were being mistreated and that they were dying without veterinary care, and most notably that the crippled sows, the down sows that could no longer walk, were being hanged to death with a chain from a front loader. So she contacted the Humane Farming Association, and they contacted me and said they needed somebody undercover there to document it.
Okay, so you talk your way into a job on the farm, and you see as we see, because you have undercover cameras on you, the pigs are confined to barred cages. They stand shoulder to shoulder. And when they're pregnant, what happens?
Well, once they're pregnant, then they're moved from these gestation crates, which are so small that they literally cannot move a millimeter to either side. They are completely confined. And if they want to lie down, they have to kind of just force themselves down and plop down on part of their side or their knees. They're moved out of there into farrowing crates, which allows them to move a few inches to one side or the other. Then they'll have their piglets, and then after a couple weeks, the piglets will be taken away from them and then raised for a certain period of time until they're ready for slaughter.
And we heard how the piglets are taken away from the sows. And as we heard, if they're at all weak, the son of the farmer, Joe Wiles, would just kill them by slamming them against the wall and, you know, sort of joking about it. We see something else in this moment, too, that I want to ask you about. Your camera picks up a farm worker's face. He looks like he's about to cry. He whispers to you that he's upset, you know, that this is cruel, this is sick. It's quite a moment. Why didn't he stop it? Why didn't he, you know, he was whispering to you. Why didn't he do anything?
I think I can explain to you why he did not do anything by telling you about another worker. My audio was not working. My mic was broken on the day they were hanging the sows. But you will see the first hog that was taken care of before all the pigs were hanged. It was this one large hog that was downed on that day. He couldn't stand, and his legs were stuck underneath the gate of his pen. And when we first pulled him out, this worker, he was a new guy, and he went over to the hog, and he kind of said, "It's going to be okay, fella. You know, you're going to be all right. We're going to get you up." And moments later, we all got catch poles and were ordered to then pull him out by his legs, including his broken leg. And then he was picked up on a forklift and taken off. It took a matter of seconds for this kid to suddenly start hooting and hollering and getting into it and making jokes about this boar that just a second ago he was concerned about, because he saw his friends doing the same thing. People want to fit in. That's how you keep your job. And they're fitting in with people who have a culture of abuse there, whether it's just within the family or it's within the community. And when you work with animals like this, they'll often use the excuse of, "Why would I abuse them? I make my livelihood off of them." But it's tough working with animals. You have to make them move, and violence and pain is the most efficient way to make them move.
Well, eventually you leave the farm, you've got your film, you take it to the Humane Farming Association, they go to the state, and the case goes to court. Ken Wiles, the owner, his son Joe, and another employee are charged with animal cruelty and torture. You go to the witness stand. Now, the evidence of cruelty seems incontrovertible. You've got the film of the sows hanging and of the piglets being smashed against the wall. But then we begin to hear from the defense witness. He's a veterinarian who says that he doesn't think that the sows that are hanging are suffering. Now, he says, who knows? They could be unconscious. And here's where we realize that you don't have any audio of that moment because your recorder is broken. So we just see these images. You tell us that there's horrible screams as the sows are pushed and pulled to the hanging, and then as they hang for 4 or 5 minutes. But we don't hear that. Do you think, in retrospect, that if you'd had that sound, it would have made a difference?
Oh, yes, it would have made a difference. You would have heard screaming louder than you can believe as they were getting dragged, but the mic wasn't working.
And he was able to say, you know, we don't know, they're twitching and kicking there, but they look unconscious to me. Well, let's listen to another clip from the film. This is a man named Earl Miller. It's during a break in the trial. He's speaking in support of the Wiles.
I don't think, you know, we can have these type of people come in here and destroy our business.
We really thought that based upon the evidence that was obtained, that the community was not going to back the Wiles, and that the pork industry in general was going to say, wow, you know, hanging crippled sows to death. I mean, you know, no one's going to stand up for that. The industry did back the Wiles by saying that they're not criminals. You know, the local community did back him, and everyone seemed to feel that everything that had happened at that farm was fine. And I was baffled by that.
Well, maybe it's because they felt that their farms might be next, as we heard from that farmer, and that, you know, you come from outside. Well, ultimately, the judge ruled against the son for his cruelty toward the piglets. The son was ordered to pay a $250 fine. But the judge cleared the father of abuse in the hanging of the sows. Here's Judge Stuart Miller after his verdict.
Disposing of the hog that was in the video was an attempt to alleviate pain and an animal that could not be saved. I find personally distasteful or offensive that that, in fact, was done, but it seems that even the experts have no better way to offer.
Well, of course, the animal activists in the courtroom said, treat the animals better, and they won't have that pain and suffering. And they also say, euthanize downer animals humanely with a shot. But the farmers say that's way too expensive, you know, to call out a vet when an animal is dying. And they also say, we're just trying to meet a demand for meat in an economical way.
For them to say, hey, if you don't want it, don't buy it, that's the exact same stance that the animal rights community takes. I think that we're all in agreement on that.
Well, I want to jump in with just one last thought, and maybe I'm going too deep here, and I'm sure I'm going to hear from farmers if I am. But you are very clear about how you do this for the animals. You have a love of animals. You have, you know, dogs that you love, and you recognize that if this were another culture, this could be your dog because they eat, you know, dogs. And yet I'm wondering, too, if a side effect of your work is that you're doing this also for the farm workers, because it can't be healthy for those who and we saw them, who were disturbed by this and just, you know, buried those feelings because they had to keep a job. That can't be healthy for them either.
I don't really want to try and punish workers at factory farms and slaughterhouses. I want the companies to pay. I really don't hold the workers as responsible for what they do. I've worked at two egg farms in California, and I can tell you that we didn't get overtime unless we worked more than 10 hours a day or more than 60 hours a week. And I don't think that was right either.
He goes by the name Pete. His undercover investigations into allegations of animal cruelty on a hog farm in Ohio is featured in the HBO film Death on a Factory Farm. It airs tonight. Pete, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Our next story may not be appropriate for kids, but kids are a buzz about it. Pop singer Chris Brown has withdrawn his nominations from the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards after being charged with assaulting another favorite artist, the singer Rihanna. Kids have seen the pictures of a badly bruised Rihanna. They know Chris allegedly punched her while they sat in an SUV. They know Brown's next court date is in April, and they've heard the reports that the two might get back together.
Go! No! Go! No! Go! No!
The case has riveted kids and people who work with them. These are young girls in the Massachusetts program Girls Leap. Through self-defense, they learn to say no. Through role-playing, adults often learn which girls are in danger. Deborah Weaver is founder and director of Girls Leap. She says the goal is to help girls find their voice.
To be able to yell, stop, what are we doing here? Stop this car. And saying that to yourself, too, when your anger is going out of control.
But one problem Deborah and others are finding is that kids think girls deserve to be hit. A recent survey by the Boston Public Health Commission found that nearly half the kids said Rihanna was responsible for what happened to her. And some seniors at the Match School, a public charter school here, agreed.
My name's Saquon Creech. When I first heard about the whole situation, like, the first thought that came in my head was it's Rihanna's fault. Because Chris Brown, you never heard about Chris Brown hitting on anybody. So that's why I thought it must have been Rihanna's fault, because she had to do something to provoke Chris Brown to hit her like that.
He beat her to a pulp, Saquon.
Yeah, I saw it. But, I mean, I don't know enough about the relationship to say whether or not his beating of her was acceptable or not.
My name is Denise. I totally disagree. She had knots on her forehead, bite marks, a busted nose, scratch marks on her face. Like, I think after that, there is no working out. And especially because they're celebrities, yes, we can say this is their personal life, but the reality is, when people see them, now they're going to think, oh, Rihanna got abused, and it's okay because she's back with Chris Brown.
He beat her like he was fighting for his life. He bit, scratched, and punched her. There's no way you can say, oh, we got in an argument, so I attacked her like she came at me with a knife. If you attack with words, just reply back with words, and I think he needs anger management.
High schoolers aren't the only ones reacting. Nick Shiggs-Caroga is a third-grade teacher at Neighborhood House Charter School in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Nick, we understand that your 8-year-olds have some pretty strong reactions to this.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot. A lot of them have the right views. They understand that hitting another woman is just something that you're just not supposed to do. But especially from some of my girls, the things that I'm hearing are more like, it's bad that he did that, but, you know, it's Chris Brown, so, you know, he didn't mean it, you know, or it's he won't do it again, or it was a mistake, you know, kind of giving him, like, you know, that free pass.
But it is true that Chris Brown, he's not one of the singers that has misogynist lyrics. He's, you know, you're nodding yes. He's the nice, sweet guy with the gum floating around him in a commercial, you know?
No, and it's true. The lights are not kind of flashing in that same sense in their heads, well, you know, about it being something that's negative.
It sounds like what you're saying is that it's a betrayal. They can't accept that it's a betrayal.
Exactly.
What do you as a teacher do with this? Do you turn it into a lesson, or how do you?
I feel if kids are talking about it, you know, then it should be discussed. So, for example, one of the things that was said from one of my students was that she would bail Chris Brown out. This is an 8-year-old. Then she said, if even if it happened to her, she would still bail him out. And that's when, like, it really, it was just like, whoa, okay. Right. Like, we need to talk about, you know, our self-esteem, our image of ourselves, like, well, how, you know, respecting ourselves. You know, I asked her, like, do you really honestly feel that way? And she said, yeah, you know, Chris Brown, I don't think he meant to do it. You know, I think it was a mistake. And, you know, to me, I was like, you know, I'm like, honey, like, it doesn't matter who the person is. You know, we can't stand for that. And you as a woman, as a young, you know, woman who you'll grow up to be, you have to represent yourself in a better way than that, you
have
know.
Better self-esteem.
Exactly.
We understand, too, that some of the students felt that Rihanna had to have done something to deserve it. And did one child say something about how she, you're nodding yes, she gave, what will you tell me, what happened?
Basically, it's actually the same student. The following day comes in and says, Mr. Shiggs, I know why Chris Brown and Rihanna got in the fight. And at that point, I heard rumors either, you know, that the night before, earlier that day, that it was an STD. And that was the reason why.
Sexually transmitted disease, right?
Exactly. So in my head, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is not going to be good.
This is what the child's going to say.
The child's going to say this, and I'm not prepared to have 20 parents call me tomorrow morning talk about my child went home talking about an STD today in third grade. So she comes on and says, the reason why Chris Brown hit Rihanna was because Rihanna gave Chris Brown diabetes. And, you know, and it was one of those things where I was a big sigh of relief, you know, obviously. But
you thought she was going to say the rumor you had heard that she had given Chris Brown a sexually transmitted disease.
Exactly.
And you thought this was going to be coming up in your third grade class. Instead, she had it completely confused.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, what's not funny is that she thought that Rihanna did something to deserve being hit.
Exactly, exactly.
So what are you saying? This is in an open classroom.
Exactly. Like, I guess I wanted them to at least see, like, all right, if this happens, this kind of stuff happens, there's consequences for this stuff. It's not okay. And one of the things with the whole reports about them getting back together, a lot of my kids even, you know, said it's going to happen again.
But in a way, isn't that good that they know that, it, you know, maybe it isn't a one-time thing and you have to be careful.
You have to be careful. And I think, it, like, certain things they do understand and they grasp. But I'm still worried that even though they understand that, like I said, you know, like some of my girls, she does understand it's wrong. But there's so many other things that she can't get past. You know, she thinks it's wrong, just like a mistake of, I got up out of my seat without raising my hand. I mean, this is so much more severe than just your normal misbehaving.
I suppose it's naive to think that these kids don't know about domestic abuse. It's not like you're telling them something they don't know. You're shaking your head.
No, I mean, I think one of the reasons why they had so much to say is either because they've experienced it in their own lives. I mean, I have kids are coming and talking to me about subjects that are just way, you know, so much mature than, you know, what we need to be talking about in third grade.
Wow, what a time for teachers.
Yeah, you know, it's just, you know, if you be prepared to talk about more than just math and reading.
Yeah. Nick Shiggs Quiroga, third grade teacher at Neighborhood House Charter School in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.